The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Forces and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday, the 8th of May. But in the interests of saving lives, the ceasefire began yesterday to be sounded along all the fronts. The German war is therefore at an end. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. Today is Victory in Europe Day.
Today is Victory in Europe Day. Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And that we just heard there was Winston Churchill announcing the end of World War II, or at least the World War II in Europe, that the Germans had surrendered and that they had a time of celebration in Victory in Europe Day, VE Day. Well, here in the United Kingdom, all kinds of celebrations and pageantry had been planned for this 75th anniversary of this day. The government had moved a bank holiday or a national holiday so that today would be and still is a national holiday. Even with the corona lockdown in place, there are places planning self-distancing street parties. The village that I live in, they're all getting ready to do that this afternoon, where I think the plan is everyone's going to have picnics on their front lawns or on their driveway, and everyone will still try and get together in the streets as best as they can to celebrate this day. As I said, all kinds of parades and things had been planned for London, and I'm sure if it weren't for Corona, there would have been massive crowds down there. The Red Arrows were flying over an empty London this morning in celebration, and the BBC has a whole special program all throughout the day celebrating this VE Day and looking at the important history from this day. And a big anniversary like VE Day, it's one of the few times that we pause as a nation, or nations, many nations celebrating this day around the world, that we pause and remember this history. But it's critical that we do. There is a huge lesson that is being overlooked in these VE Day celebrations that would save our nations today, that even we can learn from individually. Now, as we look back at World War II and some of this history, it's important to see it the way that people at the time did. We tend to look back on World War II and kind of see it as this inevitable victory, a foregone conclusion. The Allies were always going to win. Germany, Japan, and Italy, three relatively small nations. Well, they were going up against the whole rest of the world combined. Of course they were going to lose. With hindsight, it's easy to look at it that way. But that is not how people saw it at the time. That's not how great historians see it now. Historian Andrew Roberts, who wrote, "There was nothing inevitable about the Allies' victory in the conflict of 1939 to 1945. There's another historian, Bevan Alexander. He wrote a whole book called How Hitler Could Have Won World War II. Here's a clip from that historian, Bevan Alexander, giving a speech and talking about some of his experience even during that time.
Today, it's not easy to resurrect the intense clutch of fear that gripped the world 60 years ago. I was a boy growing up during the war, and I remember vividly the terror everyone felt that Germany might win. The horrible world Hitler wanted to create was not then some unreal bad dream, but a clear and present danger. The victory of freedom over tyranny was a near thing. As I have tried to show in my book, the outcome could just as well gone the other way.
So it was a near thing. There was a real fear for people 75, 80 years ago into World War II that they could lose. They were justified in having that fear. The Axis powers could have taken over the world. So how did they react during World War II when there was that real fear? I mean, you can understand why there was such relief and rejoicing when VE Day finally came, and we'll see some of the footage of that, I think, a bit later. But why did the Allies win and the Axis lose? Was it bad decisions by Hitler or stubborn resistance from Winston Churchill? Endurance from Russia, the massive industrial might and sacrifice of the United States? Well, all of these played their role. But the most critical reason why the Allies won is way far too often, almost completely wiped out of the history books, airbrushed from history. Did you know that Britain held a total of 7 days of prayer during World War II? 7 different days of prayer. I mean, you look at this history, it's remarkable how under all of that pressure, under this real threat that they could lose, Britain turned to God in prayer. Here, for example, this is King George ahead of the very first day of prayer that came just a little bit after Winston Churchill became Prime Minister, just a few days. Here's a recording from the start of his announcement calling the whole nation to prayer.
At this fateful hour we turn, as our fathers before us have turned in all times of trial to God Most High. Here in the old country, I have asked that Sunday next should be observed as a day of national prayer. It may be possible for many of our brothers to join their prayers with ours. Let us, with one heart and soul, humbly but confidently commit our cause to God and ask His aid that we may valiantly defend the right as it is given to us to see it.
So that was the king addressing the whole nation, calling everybody to prayer. And these days of prayer were a big deal. On that day, that was May 26th, 1940, shops closed. The Church of England, the Catholic Church, Jews, all the other religions, they appealed to God for help on this day. This is from the Times of London. They wrote, in cities and towns, leaders of civic life attended church on this national day of prayer at the head of their people. From peaceful villages, churches in the remote countryside, the same prayers were offered, just as in these fateful hours, the same thoughts are in people's minds. The Archbishop of Canterbury called at everyone at noon to pause every day and pray for deliverance in the time ahead. Newspapers around this time were even giving advice on how to pray. Here is a news clip just from the standard news reporting at that time on this day of prayer. This is clip 4.
The Empire responds to the King's call. And at Westminster Abbey, heart of the Empire, the statesmen, the soldiers, the ambassadors, and hundreds of ordinary men and women join the mighty congregation. Her Majesty Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands arrives a few moments before their Majesties. No one here today could foresee the grave news that has come from Belgium. All the more, it is well for us to show the world that we still believe in divine guidance, in the laws of Christianity. May we find inspiration and faith from this solemn day.
As someone brought up in modern Britain, These newsreels, these newspaper articles, it's almost hard for me to believe them. It's almost like reading about another country or some kind of alien world or something like that. I mean, it's just the idea that you would have on the nightly news, something like that, something like we just saw, with crowds of British people going to church, with a news announcer talking favorably about, well, you know, as a nation, we all need to pray and endorsing that, encouraging that. It's just totally different from the Britain that I've known all of my life. And the contrast is huge. Right now, we're in the midst of the coronavirus lockdown. And deliberately, I don't want to go into that too much. If I start talking about coronavirus, it will be kind of hard to stop in a lot of ways. There's a lot of frustrations with that. But a lot of people, including the Queen, they've been calling this a World War II level crisis. Okay, well, let's take that at face value. Let's say this is as bad as World War II, just for argument's sake. Well, I haven't seen a single person, not even just an insignificant journalist from a newspaper that you don't read that often, no one I've seen calling for a day of prayer like we did, well, in World War II, in this massive crisis. It's nowhere. I mean, you can see if Britain facing a World War II type crisis today, well, no, we wouldn't turn to God like we did then. You wouldn't have these massive days of prayer like we did then. But that day of prayer that we saw that one in May, it set a pattern that was just repeated throughout the war. Now, here's footage from another day of prayer. This day of prayer was held in September 1942 as the nation, on the anniversary, I think it was, of the nation going to war, at least marking the nation being at war for 3 years. This is clip five.
Service men and women parade for a special service at a Royal Air Force station on the National Day of Prayer, when the people of Britain are assembling all over the country to ask for divine guidance and to acknowledge their dependence upon the overruling power of God. A scene which typifies the spirit of service as we enter the fourth year of war. Men of proven courage and valor, seeking through prayer God's help and blessing in the stern tasks that lie ahead of them.
So again, you just see all of these crowds of people, the whole, and again, on the nightly news, talking about the importance of this day of prayer. I mean, these days we get the national healthcare workers out for maybe a minute's silence, and we clap at 8 p.m. for the NHS. And could you imagine today in Britain instead having all the hospital workers out parading or standing to some kind of attention like that? I mean, I guess not military parades, but out there for a day of prayer, seeking God's help in this crisis. Well, we don't do that today. We would ridicule that idea today. But look at what people were broadcasting on their nightly news back then. This is just another short clip from that broadcast that is so revealing about the different attitude towards prayer back in 1942. This is clip six.
2 years ago at this time, the gallant few of the RAF were meeting the full weight of Germany's Air Force in the Battle of Britain. Today, that small company of heroes has grown to an aerial host. Look back through history and find how the people of this land of ours have always committed their cause to Almighty God. These are modern crusaders who are not ashamed to pray.
Could you imagine a news anchor saying that on the mainstream news in the UK or even the US? Look back at our... I mean, first of all, how many news anchors would even say, look back at our history? I mean, they don't even talk about history very much. But saying, well, look back at our history. Here's a lesson that you need to learn from our history. That our nation has always turned to God in prayer in times of crisis. That's what we can learn from our history. And we are not ashamed that we're turning to God in prayer now. The news announcer saying that. That's how our nations turned to prayer in the past. I mean, I don't think I've ever really seen much of this footage before looking into and getting some of this ready. I mean, this type of footage isn't the footage that we air from World War II today. This history doesn't make up really a part of our remembrance services. They weren't ashamed to pray, but now we're ashamed of that history. We're ashamed that they did pray. And we don't talk about that at all. Here's another clip from a different news broadcast on that same day. This is clip 7.
The anniversary was remembered too in barracks, aboard ship, in cathedrals, and in little churches, many of which show the scars of battle. Up and down the country, work virtually ceased for a short time while the people of Britain renewed the pledge they made on that fateful Sunday 3 years ago. We little realized then the course the war would take. We know now. With renewed resolution and with God's help, we shall go forward to final victory.
If you're watching that on the YouTube stream, you can see all of this moving footage of people crowding together in these bombed out churches. You know, the roof is gone. The windows are all blown out. People are having to try and sit around piles of rubble because these churches have still been destroyed, have all been destroyed. I think there was also a bit of a misprint on there. It said 1945. That was from 1942. So still in the midst of the war. But look at these people, their dedication to gathering together in prayer. And I'm not saying that these people were living by every word of God, but as best they knew how, they were seeking God's help. And America's history with this and with World War II, it's exactly the same. Here's how President Roosevelt announced the D-Day landings, for example. He began by calling the nation to prayer, to join him in prayer. And then this is a brief excerpt of that prayer that he offered up on the radio in front of the whole nation.
Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts.
That's what he told Americans, and they responded. There was a really dramatic response to that call to prayer. This is what the American historian Stephen Ambrose wrote in his book D-Day. He wrote, "The impulse to pray was overwhelming. Many people got their first word of the invasion as they began their daily routines. After they recovered their breath, they said a silent prayer. Others heard the news broadcast on loudspeakers during their night shifts on assembly lines around the country. Men and women paused over their machines, prayed, and returned to work with renewed dedication. Across the United States and Canada, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Arctic to the Gulf Coast, the church bells rang, not in triumph or celebration, but as a solemn reminder of national unity and a call to formal prayer. Special services were held in every church and synagogue in the land. Pews were jammed with worshippers." And he has some really interesting details in that book where he talks about America's response. There was one department store, I think it was Lords and Taylor, that just the business runner said, "Well, we're just not going to open today." And he sent, you know, he told all of his employees, all 3,000 of them, instead of coming to work, go home and pray. Pray for the success of this day. There are other stores that were closing early and things like that. As everyone tried to make time for their people, not with the lockdown like we have today, where everyone's just staying at home and in too many cases, streaming videos and, you know, week after week not doing anything productive. It was a shutdown so that people had time to pray, to look for God's help. We've got some footage of that, actually. It's a bit, we can jump ahead to clip chapter 10. This is how America responded this is part of America's response to VE Day. Clip 10.
Throughout the world, throngs of people hailed the end of the war in Europe. It is 5 years and more since Hitler marched into Poland. Years full of suffering and death and sacrifice.
Now the war against Germany is won. A grateful nation gives thanks for victory. Hundreds of thousands crowd into American churches to give thanks to God.
So hundreds of thousands crowded into churches to pray and give thanks. So what was the result of our nation's praying like this, of 7 days of prayer held during the war for Britain, for all of these days of prayer and these calls for prayer? Well, you know, let's be good historians and look at first-hand sources. Don't just take my word for it. Let's look at some of the results, some of the fruits, and let's look at what some of the what the leaders of the war said from Britain and America. So the first day of prayer came right around the Dunkirk evacuation. The government, their kind of best case scenario for how many people they were going to evacuate from the beaches of Dunkirk, the whole British Expeditionary Force, basically Britain's whole army, was trapped there. The government believed they'd only be able to save 45,000. They ended up saving 335,000. Massively more. The Daily Telegraph wrote in July 8th, 1940, "Those who accustomed to the channel testified to the strangeness of this calm. They are deeply impressed by the phenomenon of nature by which it became possible for tiny craft to go back and forth in safety." So they saw that it was strange, and people at the time said, well, they gave credit to God for this strange, unusual weather. There was a fog that protected those on the beach from planes, and then the calm water allowed all these small boats to come and help evacuate them. And people still had to do their part. There were still huge numbers of incredibly brave people, many of them not even in the armed forces, who were taking their small boats across to go and rescue these people. But there was a miracle from God in there as well. The Times of London, they published a whole series of letters. Here's one. "The fortitude displayed and the success achieved are to me at least miracles and an answer to the prayers which rose up from the empire and from millions outside it on May 26th. Let us not forget to return thanks." Another, "Surely our prayers have been answered in the merciful deliverance of our expeditionary force from their complete destruction. Thanksgiving is surely as important as supplication, and there must be many who feel, like myself, that we ought to have a special day of thanksgiving to God for his wonderful answer to our prayers." The Times wrote that these letters, they wrote that they are two out of a very large number addressed to the Times in the same sense. So they had so many letters of people saying, well, this is obviously answered prayer. They kind of had the special article saying, well, look, we've had a whole load of these letters. Here are some examples of them. And so on June 9th, Britain did go back to church for a national day of thanksgiving. And again, here's from The Telegraph, another mainstream publication. "One thing can be certain about tomorrow's thanksgiving in our churches. From no one will the thanks ascend with greater sincerity or deeper fervor than from the officers and men who have seen the hand of God, powerful to save, delivering them from the hands of a mighty foe who, humanly speaking, had them utterly at his mercy." These are mainstream sources. Even Time magazine had an article a little bit later in the war talking about the remarkable miracles that followed on from these days of prayer. You know, mainstream sources. And can you imagine Time magazine publishing something like that today? Britain's second and third days of prayer, they came during the Battle of Britain, where the German Air Force was trying to clear out the RAF so that they could clear the way for a Nazi invasion. Now, Britain won that battle, and Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding, so the person right at the top of the Air Force, you can't get any more senior within the Air Force, he said, "I will say with absolute conviction that I can trace the intervention of God." He said, "Humanly speaking, victory was impossible." You can always go by day of prayer and look at the remarkable results that followed on from them. But all of the senior commanders, they credited this. General Eisenhower, he said, "If there was nothing else in my life to prove the existence of an almighty and merciful God, the events of the next 24 hours did it. That was him writing about D-Day. After America had stopped for prayer like that, after Britain had held its final day of prayer with the war, that was the supreme commander of the Allied forces, Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, the commander of the British forces on D-Day and the land forces. He wrote, "Such a historic march of events can seldom have taken place in such a short space of time. Let us say to each other, this was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes." Lieutenant General Sir Frederick Morgan, he did most of the planning for D-Day as Chief of Staff to the Supreme Allied Commander. So, again, one of the top people, one of the people that knew the most about what happened in D-Day, one of the people that was involved more than almost anybody else in everything that was going on there, getting all of this prepared, in all of the details and things like that. You know, even more than the senior leadership, you'd expect somebody at that level that's kind of doing all the nuts and bolts to really know what's going on. He wrote a whole article for the Telegraph after the war titled The Miracle of D-Day. And in it, he talks about, well, not just D-Day, but over and over again, things like the Allied landing in North Africa, how you would have perfect weather conditions, how things just kept just working out. And in response to these miracles and to these events, the British government even took steps to make the nation more religious. In 1944, even while the war was still going on, the government passed the Educations Act. And this called for local educational authorities to be responsible for improving the spiritual and moral health of the nation. It required that all schools hold a daily act of collective worship. Now, it didn't specify what worship, and it allowed all kinds. It allowed exemptions for conscience, and people could, students could, you know, their parents could pull people out if it was for a different religion, and teachers wouldn't be forced to be involved. But they wanted to make sure that school pupils were brought up being taught about this, that they were brought up being educated about God and worshiping God. And so they said, well, all schools, we've got to have a day and a time of collective worship. And again, I'm not saying that what was taught during those times of collective worship was perfect by any means. But look at that response. 1944, during the war, right towards the end, to say, well, we need to make sure that we're turning to God more, so we need to get our schools involved in doing this. And actually, that requirement is still technically in place today, even though it's ignored by the vast majority of schools at the moment. And then here's what the King said on VE Day, 75 years ago today, how he announced this, or spoke to the nation on this day of celebration. This is clip 9.
But today, we give thanks to God for a great deliverance. Speaking from our empire's oldest capital city, war battered, I was never for one moment daunted or dismayed. Germany, the enemy who drove all Europe into war, has been finally overcome. In the Far East, we have yet to deal with the Japanese, a determined and cruel foe. The Queen and I know that the ordeals which you have endured throughout the Commonwealth and Empire, we are proud to have shared some of them with you. And we know also that we shall all face the future together. In the hour of danger, we humbly committed our cause into the hand of God. And he has been our strength and shield. Let us thank him for his mercies. And in this hour of victory, commit ourselves and our new task to the guidance of the same strong hand.
So giving thanks to God, crediting God with the victory, with the celebrations that were going on that day, that was a core part of the king's message to the nation. And reminding them that God had helped them win this victory, giving thanks to God for doing that. I happened to notice this morning that the official royal Twitter account tweeted out a part of that speech. I think it was even in that segment. But it didn't include the beginning, and it didn't include the end that we just watched here, where the king gives thanks to God. You know, that's not the important bit of history that we remember today. And once again, you had exactly the same response in the United States, where leaders gave thanks to God for that victory. President Harry Truman, at that point, he had stepped in, he'd become president. He appointed May 13th as a day of prayer. He said, "I call upon the people of the United States, whatever their faith, to unite in offering joyful thanks to God for the victory we have won, and to pray that he will support us to the end of our present struggle and to guide us into the way of peace." That's not a sentiment we hear from our leaders very often. Now, I think you do hear it from political leaders in the United States a bit more than you do in the UK. I think we'd certainly never hear it from a modern British leader. But even in the United States, people paid much more attention to those kind of statements back then than they do now. And you saw some of those pictures of packed churches and people going to give thanks to God on VE Day. So these were not insignificant individuals calling for prayer and then acknowledging the results. These were just about all of the top leaders of Britain and America. But like I've been alluding to, you hear almost nothing about this when World War II is taught. We talk about this aspect of things so little. It's an absolutely remarkable aspect of World War II that is almost never discussed. And why don't historians get into this more? Why don't they remember this more? Well, the Trumpet editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, he talked about exactly this subject. Not D-Day, but how historians leave God out of history in his Key of David. So that came just over a week ago. And if you haven't seen it, I really urge you to go and watch it. What we've looked at with what happened on D-Day is just a perfect example of what he was talking about. The historians just airbrush God out of that history. Here's how he began that Key of David program. This is clip 11.
"Greetings, everyone. By what authority have historians left God and the Bible out of history? What authority do they have to leave God and the Bible out of their modern history?" Dr. Herman Hay asked that question in his book that he wrote in 1962, and he was very much concerned about that question, and at the time he was a professor at Ambassador College, and asked that question to begin with, and it was rather certainly stunning to me when I heard it. That's really one of the most profound questions you could ask at this time, and of our historians especially.
So that's an important question. By what authority have the historians left God out of the history? And you look at this history and you can clearly see that they have. Here's some more quotes from that history book from Dr. Hay. He wrote, "This question may seem as a surprise. Many are unaware that a radically new interpretation of history is being taught in schools and colleges today. It is a history of the world in which God and the supernatural are rejected." And that's true, isn't it? You know, that's what we see with this World War II history, this assumption that, well, God can't be real. So there's no need to pay attention to just these superstitious services that they held back then. They were just a more superstitious people, a less advanced people than we are. So we're a little bit ashamed and embarrassed that they held on to those superstitions. And so we just let that slide out of the history books. We don't even bother talking about it. When you actually go back and look at the history, and all of those top leaders of World War II credited God for miracles. But we just ignore that. It's just all based on the assumption that there's nothing supernatural. Nothing happening in the supernatural. We can ignore that. But you look back at World War II and that history, and you can see why it's so dangerous to leave God out of that history. I mean, you would have thought that even just from a, even an atheist, just writing the history from a purely academic point of view, purely historical point of view, that it would be important to know that these allied leaders believed God was on their side, that they sought his help, and that they credited him with their victories. You know, just from an understanding the history perspective. But instead, that's almost never mentioned. I think to his credit, Steve Ambrose is one of the few that does bring that in his book on D-Day. He has a good-sized section in there on the response of the American public, on that religious response. But very few people even mention that. And that's dangerous, leaving that out. Mr. Flurry, in his book, The Former Prophets, he wrote, many authorities call history our most effective teacher. He said in that book a bit later, British and American leaders have been utterly contemptuous of World War II history that cost 50 million lives. Our nations will pay dearly for such dangerous contempt of history. And they'll pay dearly, especially for the dangerous contempt of this history with God. What would happen? What would we be reminded of if the full history of World War II was reviewed today? If as a whole nation, Britain, America, France, the Soviet Union, even all the Allies, and the whole world, if we came to remember and remember this history without God airbrushed out of it, what lessons would we learn? And would we be reminded that we live in a dangerous world where there are evil dictators that plot and scheme, that there are evil men who will take advantage of the West and of democracy's desires for peace? They'll take advantage of our collective reluctance to confront evil. They'll try and build their own power. They'll ultimately try and use that to destroy us. That there are evil forces out there that will try to divide our nations, to try and use our own media against us. We'd be reminded that we must not take freedom, prosperity, security for granted. That there are really dangerous threats out there. That Britain and America could well have lost that war. They could have been swallowed up in what Churchill called a new dark age. So we'd be reminded of the dangerous world that we live in. But looking at this, if we really reviewed this full history, well, we'd also be taught to how to react to this dangerous world. The key to be to safety and security as nations and as individuals. We would learn that there is a God that intervenes powerfully in world affairs, that changes the course of history. A God that responds to repentance and prayer. With a full account of this history, VE Day could be an annual reminder of our need for God, nationally and individually, even without cracking open your Bible. Just an honest look at history, you can get a profound education from that. Now, of course, we do need to crack open the Bible to learn, well, then, okay, well, how do we seek this God? How do we obey God? What do we need to do to have him intervene in our nations, intervene in our lives? How do we worship him in the way that he tells us to worship him? But just that study of history, well, that would point us to God if we studied it honestly. Romans chapter 1 and verse 18. I'll just read this from the New King James Version. It says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth. Now, the key of David, or the King James Version talks about hold the truth. Better translation there is suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So God says, well, his wrath is revealed against those that suppress the truth, that hide truth, that there are people out there that man hides truth. And that God is wrathful with them. While you study this history, you can see why. The true history of World War II, it gives the nation-saving lessons. And yet those nation-saving lessons have been suppressed. Here's what Mr. Flurry said about this verse in his Key of David program. This is clip 12.
Suppressed. They suppress the truth. They omit it. They interpret it. They really do some terrible things to get God out of the picture. Man has always done that, anciently and in modern times, but it's worse now in the modern times. They just eliminate God in the Bible from their history. That's modern history.
Modern history just eliminates God, gets rid of God, airbrushes him from the record. But how better off would we be if we didn't suppress that history, if we listened to that history? Mr. Furry went on to talk about how wrathful God is about this suppression. This is clip 13.
The historical method, as they talk about, is simply an hypothesis, quote, that God has never and does not now intervene in or determine the course of history. That's their guess. God never intervenes. There's nothing, no superpower that intervenes in this world. Absolutely not. Well, I'll tell you, he has been for over 75 years intervening in this world, and anybody ought to be able to see it and could see it and prove it if they were just willing to do so. Our work is certainly seen to that truth. The historical method is just their hypothesis to kick God, rip him right out of history, and rip the Bible right out of history. And what does God think about that? Well, he says, you're going to be entertaining my wrath. I mean, really, I don't blame me for this. This is what God says.
So they're just ripping God out of history. And look what it does. Suppressing the life-saving solution to our problems. Like I said, we do still need to turn to the Bible rather than our own ideas to know how to seek God's help and intervention in our lives. But that history is inspiring proof of God's power to intervene. So there is a lot to celebrate on VE Day today. There are many fantastic lessons that we can learn as well from the bravery and the sacrifice of the men who fought in that war. And we've talked about some of those even on this show, especially if you go back a year ago when we were talking about D-Day and some of the things going on there and the heroism on display there. On this day, we can be reminded of God's very real power in the world. Then putting God back into that history, it makes it interesting. It makes it uplifting and inspiring as well. And Mr. Flory pointed out this in this Key of David, that taking God out of the history, well, that makes it boring and confusing. This is we'll play one last clip from that Key of David program.
They just talk about, well, Jesus Christ being a myth, and all these they're doing is watering down the history, and now 55 colleges and universities required a course in American history, and 78% of the students got by without taking any history at all. It's getting boring. It's disinteresting. They've taken God out, and it's confusing. It's confusing. And the students are bored, and they just, well, without God, it's just confusing. It's chaotic. Thank God that God has proven himself. So that's the great news.
And look how exciting and interesting history is when you put God back in. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was looking into all this material, watching that video footage, going through some of these old newspapers, it was exciting. It was inspiring. It was interesting. It was some of the most fun I've had researching something. I always enjoy researching things. It's not like I don't enjoy it. But this definitely stands out as a really exciting thing to research. Because when you put God back into that history, it makes it come alive so much more. And it doesn't take away from any of those inspiring stories of individual heroism that you can read about. It adds to them. And if you want to do more of this, if you want to put more of God back into history, well, I'd really recommend our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, our free book. All of our material is free. And that book shows you God's plan in world events. It explains what God's been doing throughout man's history and what he will do today. It will show you specific prophecies that were fulfilled during World War II and elsewhere. That book brings history and the Bible together, and it makes them both come alive. If you really digest that book and then go back and study history, that really does make that history come alive, because once you understand God's plan in history, well, then you see his hand everywhere, making sure that plan is fulfilled, bringing it to pass. So that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, is a great way to put God back into your study of history. I'll also mention we have a history program on the KPCG, Rewind Repeat, that goes through history with God still in the picture, explaining some of those, explaining God's role in that history. So, like I said, you can order that book online. Just go to our website, thetrumpet.com, or send us a message, td@kpcg.fm. You can read it online. We'd be more than happy to send you a free copy. I think we ship just about anywhere in the world. So please do take advantage of that if you haven't already. Read that book and help put God back into history. Well, we've got a few minutes left. We'll take a short break, and when we get back, we'll talk about some of the other important news events from this week.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. An exciting, pulsating, vital third of all the Bible is devoted to prophecy. And approximately 90% of all prophecy pertains to our time, now, in this 21st century. It is a warning to us, to our English-speaking peoples, of immediate life and death import. The prophecies come alive once their doors are opened by this now-discovered master key. The United States and Britain in prophecy will open, to open minds, this hitherto closed vital third of all the Bible. No story of fiction ever was so strange, so fascinating, so absorbing, so packed with interest and suspense as this gripping story of our identity and our ancestry. Request the United States and Britain in Prophecy and a free one-year subscription to the Trumpet magazine right now. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And we've been spending most of our time so far this morning talking about VE Day. But there are a couple of other big stories I wanted to take a few minutes to hit on that have been going on this week, that have been buried a bit by all of the coronavirus coverage, and that relate really strongly to that first segment. The first story is directly about history from World War II. There have been some historians from Germany, from around the world, but one in particular from Germany, that has been publishing some important findings recently. Now, you may be aware that Pope Francis opened up the Vatican archive. So for a long time, there's been, I guess people would call it a controversy, where over how much the Pope during World War II supported the Nazis, supported the Holocaust, this kind of thing. You had John Cornwell wrote a very famous book in the 1990s called Hitler's Pope, where, I'll just quote from him. He said, "My research told the story of a bid for unprecedented papal power that by 1933 had drawn the Catholic Church into complicity with the darkest forces of the era. I found evidence, moreover, that from an early stage in his career, Pacelli," that was the man who went on to become the Pope, "betrayed an undeniable antipathy towards the Jews, and that in his diplomacy in Germany in the 1930s had resulted in the betrayal of Catholic political associations that might have challenged Hitler's regime and thwarted the final solution." So he went in there trying to clear the Pope, and he came up with a very different conclusion. Now, to try and refute some of this, in 2019, Pope Francis announced that he would open up the Vatican archives relating to this period to a team of researchers. And he did that on March the 2nd this year. There are 60 independent researchers that were cleared by the Vatican. I think 200 or so applied, but they approved 60 of them at least. And they went there for a very short period of time before they closed it up due to the coronavirus. But a team from the University of Munster, led by Herbert Wolf, he was a historian of the Catholic Church, and he put out his conclusions recently, and they make very remarkable reading. They were all in the news this week. he went in there and said he found evidence that the highest levels of the Vatican knew about the Holocaust and what was happening as early as August 1942, but that they dismissed it, they ignored it. And his report has a whole load of different details of which documents were submitted when. Brent Nachtigall wrote that up for the website. We have an article on that's called "The Vatican Knew of Jewish Genocide but did Nothing." If you want to learn more about this story, you can go there and you can follow all of the details. And it goes through letter after letter showing that the Pope knew about this, and all these different letters in the archive showing that he'd been told, which obviously raises some questions about the Catholic Church's later defense that, well, he didn't know anything. He told a Munster Catholic paper that this is a key document, talking about one of these documents that he found, that has been kept hidden from us because it is clearly anti-Semitic and provides background on why Pius XII did not speak out against the Holocaust. So a lot of information about this coming out. Brent, in his article, also talked about how in December 17th, 1942, the Pope had a broadcast which was the perfect opportunity to speak out against the Holocaust. But in that 26 pages of text of that broadcast, there were 27 words in there that only vaguely related to the Holocaust. And another story from this week along similar lines, Germany's Council of Catholic Bishops, they came out and admitted that many of them complied with Adolf Hitler. They released a document that said most of them bolstered the German nation's will to endure. They made themselves complicit in the war, talking about the German bishops. The bishops may not have shared the Nazis' justification for the war on the grounds of racial ideology, they wrote, but their words and their images gave succor both to soldiers and the regime prosecuting the war, as they lent the war an additional sense of purpose. So that's the modern German bishop saying, well, yeah, we lent the Nazis a sense of purpose. The Times of London went through that document. They said it notes that hundreds of priests were dispatched to accompany the Wehrmacht on the front lines. Thousands of church and monastic properties were converted into military hospitals, and tens of thousands of nuns fulfilled their duty to the fatherland by acting as nurses. It goes on to talk about how, you know, when Germany invaded Poland, that there was only one exception, one bishop, but the rest of them all roused their followers to patriotic obedience. That there was Cardinal Adolf Bertram who was telling the bishops that they shouldn't speak out against the regime, that they should support it. And then the Times had even more detail on that. So there's a lot of important history. That's another area of important history to look into. Why was this organization silent about the Holocaust? Why was this organization supporting the Nazis? Why were so many of these bishops? And you don't need to believe me for saying that. This is directly from Germany's current Council of Bishops. They lent the war an additional sense of purpose. Why would those bishops do that? Well, that's an important question to answer. That's an important area. If we look into that, that's another area where study that and you can see God in history. And you can read our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. That will explain why this church worked with the Nazis. What's going on there? What that means for the future. God has some very specific prophecies and things to say about Europe and the Catholic Church. And that's another of our free booklets, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. And one more story, I'll just only barely be able to draw your attention to it, but I'll talk about this more on Trumpet Hour, our other news show that'll be on later today on kpcg.fm. You can hear more about this and much more on that show. But we saw some very important news from Germany's High Court this week. Germany's Supreme Court. They issued a landmark ruling in a court case that had been brought by a bunch of economists. These economists were upset with the way the European Central Bank had been operating. And in this court case, basically the German Constitutional Court appointed themselves the highest authority in Europe. They made clear, well, We're above the European Court of Justice. We're more powerful than them, and that's really rocked Europe. And it's going to continue to rock Europe. One of the things that they said is that the European Central Bank, you know, basically they've got 3 months to stop printing money, which you've got this situation in Europe right now where either the euro falls apart or northern countries, Germany, bails out Italy. And there's tough decisions to make. And the European Central Bank is printing money, so they don't need to make those tough decisions yet, because you don't need to when the European Central Bank is just printing money to pay the bills. So by saying, well, you've got to stop those printing presses, the German Constitutional Court could well bring on a crisis. And for a long time, Herbert W. Armstrong, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flory have been pointing to, well, watch for a crisis in Europe, because the Bible has some specific prophecies to say about Europe. And so watch for those crises, because those crises are going to transform Europe into the Europe of your Bible. So another important story to keep an eye on what's going on in Europe over there. And again, you can learn much more about that from our free booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. And that's about all that I have time for. You can get that book I mentioned earlier, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that other book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can email us. You can do that at td@kpcg.fm. We'd be very happy to hear from you. Keep an eye out for Trumpet Hour on later, and tune in next time when the Trumpet Daily Radio Show is back on Monday.